So Wretched of the Earth was forged in the heat of struggle. In 1960, during a heady period in the Algerian struggle for national liberation, France Fanon was diagnosed with leukemia. And at this time, that was a death sentence. And so urgently, he took it upon himself over only 4 months to write Wretched of the Earth, to put forward what he saw as urgent arguments that would forge a path forward for the anti-colonial movements across Africa. And the result is totally stunning. It's a furious critique of colonialism and a brilliant argument about the strategies, tactics and philosophy of revolution. You have to be moved by Fanon's deep and enduring humanism as he describes the pure violence by which the colonial regime was maintained, the sacrifice of human life and dignity that underscored the French occupation of Algeria. He brings to life the total hypocrisy of French idealism and nationalism, of the politicians and philosophers who espoused liberal values of a supposedly common universal humanity and then oversaw the murderous near enslavement of Algerians. And Fanon articulates an unflinching identification with the oppressed. He totally scorns everybody, whether they're a nationalist leader or a poet, who sought to better themselves off the masses' struggles for liberation. And it's clear that witnessing the most brutal attempts of French colonialism to, despite witnessing the most brutal attempts of French colonialism to break the spirit of colonised people and crush their resistance, he retained a deep belief in the potential for self-emancipation, that oppressed people could themselves rise up and overthrow the yoke of colonialism and capitalism that they supposedly didn't need, that they didn't need to look to supposedly better, smarter, more enlightened people above them or somewhere else in the world to fulfill that task. And Sartre wrote, Fanon requested that Sartre write the preface to Wretched of the Earth, and he has a line which I think quite beautifully sums up the spirit of the book, which is that the third world finds itself and speaks to itself with his, as in Fanon's, voice. So I hope to present a comradely appraisal of Wretched of the Earth. So there's lots to agree with and learn from in the book, but equally there are debates to be had. And so hopefully we can go through that today in the spirit of figuring out how best to win the liberation which Fanon so desired. So the strongest chapter of Wretched of the Earth is the pitfalls of national consciousness. Here, Fanon weighs into a key debate in the Africa-wide anti-colonial movements at the time, which was, could a struggle that ended with creating a new capitalist nation really liberate the oppressed? Fanon has a clear understanding that the anti-colonial movements were divided by class. Different sections of society with quite widely diverging interests came together under the national banner. He argues that the African middle class, the intellectuals, and the bourgeoisie did not share the desires for liberation that the oppressed majority had. Fanon described this leadership as a sort of little greedy-cased, avid and voracious, with the mind of a huckster, only too glad to accept the dividends that the former colonial power hands out to it. And that's very typical of Fanon's style of writing as well. The book is like, it's like reading a speech for 200 pages, which is quite incredible. So rather than seeking to fundamentally transform the social and economic relations of colonialism, Fanon describes that the political leadership, this political leadership made up from the this class that he described, rather just desired to take over the existing infrastructure and become a new ruling class. So he says, for them, nationalisation does not mean governing the state with regard to the new social relations whose growth it has been decided to encourage. To them, nationalisation quite simply means the transfer into native hands of those unfair advantages which are a legacy of the colonial period. So this was basically the most left-wing and radical argument advanced by any thinker in the African anti-colonial movements at this time. It was a rejoinder to the ideas that had a very long history on the left and then were repopularized under Stalinism, that political development happens in stages, and by some historical necessity, the underdeveloped world would have to first establish their own capitalism, their own national capitalism, before some kinds of fuller economic prosperity, i.e. socialism, could be achieved. So under these arguments that I just described, the interests of the hucksters were the interests of the nation, all oppressed people within it. But Fanon argues that the bourgeoisie in the underdeveloped world could not and did not want to develop the national economy in a way that lifted the oppressed majority out of poverty and advanced their democratic rights. The aspirational African bourgeoisie was strangled both by Western imperialism and their own desires for profit. So the reason for this, Fanon argues, is that the precondition for Western-style parliamentary democracy was a strong economy. And in Europe, in some bygone age, the Western bourgeoisie might have been able to play a democratic and transformative role when combating the old aristocracy. But this all occurred against the backdrop of some economic strength. It was possible to better the economic position of workers and the poor and thereby hold the nation together. This was not possible in the Third World, and indeed it had not been possible anywhere in capitalism for a very long time. Marx made arguments about this, that after the 1848 bourgeois revolutions, the ruling class had become somewhat scared of challenging things because they were scared of the masses articulating their own class demands, like workers and peasants and so on, articulating their own class demands, which challenged the social position of the bourgeoisie. So the post-colonial bourgeoisie were not simply retracing the steps of the old European ruling class from some bygone age. They were actually emulating the Western bourgeoisie of late-stage capitalism. So if they were to, and if they were to do that, like Fanon argues they did, there would be, like try and generate the same riches, the same kind of lifestyles, the same profits or whatever, there would be no space in the economy to hand over wealth to the oppressed or to take the risks that economic industrialisation for the purpose of helping the population could achieve. So Fanon says this new caste is an affront all the more disgusting in that the immense majority, 9/10 of the population, continue to die of starvation. So in their desire to become the new ruling class, the nationalist leaders did not want to smash the capitalist state, smash their relationships with Western capitalism, but to renegotiate them. Fanon argues earlier in the book, in the first chapter on violence, that the more far-sighted colonial powers could calculate that the costs of maintaining repression against an anti-colonial movement might not be worth it, but that instead, by making alliances with the political leadership of the national liberation movements, this aspirational bourgeoisie, they could maintain the same exploitative trade relationships. And he also predicted how it's actually, he's remarkably prescient, that's something that is apparent all throughout the book. He predicted how a complex system of financial enslavement might emerge via foreign aid and loans that would tie a new independent nation to Western powers. And there are also means by which the Western bourgeoisie would actively prevent the establishment of new industries, which could give post-colonial states a sort of secure, independent financial basis. So this is why Fanon says that the national middle class will have nothing better to do than to take on the role of manager for Western enterprise, and it will, in practice, set up its country as the brothel of Europe. So the tragic conclusion of all of these arguments is that if the outcome of a struggle for national liberation is just a new ruling class, the conditions of life will change very little for the oppressed. He says, the peasant who goes on scratching out a living from the soil and the unemployed man who never finds employment, in spite of do not manage, in spite of public holidays and flags, new and brightly coloured though they may be, to convince themselves that anything has really changed in their lives. And far from liberation, the new ruling class could come up with and did come up with new means of repressing the masses and seeking to argue that the interests of the ruling class are one with the nation. So the key vehicles they used to achieve this were they used the former Nationalist Party, the armed forces of the state, and through social mechanisms by entrenching various forms of oppressions. So to start with the party, Fanon endows really great responsibility to the Revolutionary Party. He argues that they play a crucial role in struggle in organising the spontaneous anger of the masses, explaining politics to them, and in so doing pointing to a liberating strategy. And by this barometer, he argues that the nationalist parties leading the anti-colonial struggle have failed on every single count. Fanon argues that during the anti-colonial period, so in the high points of struggle, the parties may have the confidence and faith of the masses. However, the leadership never see themselves as part of the masses, but above them, and that the relationship of the nationalist political leaders to the oppressed is a parasitical one. So they may wheel out a mass rally to reinforce a political point, but at the same time use their influence to suppress people making demands that actually challenge the new ruling class. So over time, far from expressing any kind of popular will, the Nationalist Party can actually become a tool for the personal advancement of politicians and the middle class. Particularly in depleted economies, the state and the political parties that run it became one of the few guaranteed avenues for riches. So the Nationalist Party, which had once been so involved in struggle, became revolutionary in appearance only. He, Fanon describes how dynamic leaders may recall the days of their participation in struggle, describing their achievements as one of the whole nations, from the poorest person to the richest, while at the same time enforcing the will of a new exploitative bourgeoisie. And so the second vehicle he talks about is the state. And Fanon argues that because the post-colonial state is overseeing a weak and underdeveloped economy, there are pressures towards very authoritarian practices. The state is too fractious, too new, too fragile. The mass of the population is also potentially too rebellious. So there isn't the space available in strong, developed capitalist economies to maintain the sham of democracy. The ruling class, they don't have very much wriggle room in really weak economies, and so they try to they desire the direct enforcement of their interests through the state. And so this is also why Fanon argues that there are tendencies towards one-party systems in post-colonial states. And this actually prefigures a point that was made later by thinkers in the international socialist tendency, which is the political strain of thought that the socialist thoughts that Socialist Alternative belongs to, who argued that Stalinist state capitalist models were an attractive thing for post-colonial movements for the reasons I just described. So the post-colonial state also tends to a greater reliance on the armed wings, so the military, the police, to maintain order, because holding fair and democratic elections, which in the West plays quite an important role of creating a sham of democracy, a sham idea that what happens in the nation is the product of some national will, was untenable in these weak conditions. Instead, what actually happens is that the newly established post-colonial state ends up carrying on the basic structure of the violent, repressive colonial state. That's because there is not space in the economy to provide for the things that would actually make people's lives better, an increase in, you know, ownership of lands for people who for peasants or for higher wages. There's not space to do those things and still for the bourgeoisie to profit. So to maintain control, maintain their system, they revert again to basic violence, the violent crushing of opposition. And Finally, Fanon talks about the social methods by which the ruling class, the new post-colonial state, held on to power. So Fanon argues that an anti-colonial struggle that limits itself to nationalism will unavoidably lead to racism and religious sectarianism. So the new domestic ruling class struggling to maintain power and the Western imperialist powers hoping to retain their influence require various forms of oppression and of obfuscation to divide the masses and keep their system in place. And this undermines the concept of African unity, which was very popular in the anti-colonial movements in this period, because the new ruling class and intellectuals in tandem, because there's just been this big struggle and a new state established, but as Fanon said earlier, things have not improved very much for people. So they need to come up with new explanations for why things are not very good. And the ruling class and intellectuals concoct these explanations. That's their job. And those are things like that the real divisions in society, the source of problems, are between people south and north of the Sahara, was the term that Fanon used, or people from different districts in a country. And he describes these processes really quite excellently, the way that both former colonial powers and a new post-colonial ruling class would consciously stoke religious sectarianism. And this has happened like not just in Africa, but across Asia as well. Things like it would change exactly the mechanisms in place to place, but giving certain economic positions to people from one religious group and so on. Like, it was consciously established religious sectarianism. And in the absence of a revolutionary party who could provide a coherent explanation of why problems persisted in society that challenged this kind of racism and religious sectarianism, people took up very backwards ideas, and it played a totally reactionary role on the consciousness of people who had previously been involved in quite radical struggle. Oppressed people could begin to locate their enemy as belonging among the masses rather than the ruling class. So Fanon describes, from nationalism we have passed to ultranationalism, to chauvinism, and finally to racism. So all of these insights about the limits of national liberation movements are stunningly and tragically accurate. Fanon's work insightfully documented processes that were taking place in the anti-colonial movements across Africa. In the post-colonial regimes, rather, across Africa. And although he never in the book does he criticise the National Liberation Front head-on, but he was a member, he was quite a senior and public figure of the FLN, but you have to wonder if he was criticising the things that he saw within his own party, because all of the criticisms that he makes entirely apply to the Algerian context. And in making these arguments, Fanon was consciously weighing into what he described as the theoretical question that for the last 50 years has been raised when the history of underdeveloped countries is under discussion, whether or not the bourgeois phase can be skipped. His answer is that not only can the bourgeois phase be skipped, but the oppressed people and a revolutionary party must consciously struggle to prevent the bourgeoisie from ever taking power. Fanon does not conceive of any bourgeoisie capable of meeting the post-colonial challenges of raising the majority of people out of poverty and of challenging the variety of backwards prejudices that prevail. So instead, he argues for an alternative to capitalism, an alternative to class rule. And these are some of the most humanist arguments made in Wretched of the Earth, that Fanon's solution is empowering the masses to run society. So he eviscerated the intellectuals and party leaders who argued that ordinary people were not capable of understanding politics. So he quipped that one of the greatest services that the Algerian revolution will have provided to the intellectuals of Algeria will be to have placed them in contact with the people, which is something we should carry into our universities today. So instead of bourgeois rule and rule by intellectuals, Fanon argues that as a collective, being the ones who actually live in and experience the world, oppressed peoples are perfectly capable of administering their economies. And by necessity, Fanon argues that this process of the oppressed masses running society would have to be international. It's only through these processes that any kind of African unity, a genuine African unity, could be achieved through the masses. And also, despite his eviscerating critiques of Western colonialism, Fanon does argue that this kind of mass struggle would have to take place in Europe as well, that the poverty of the Third World could only be overcome through solidarity with the struggles of workers and the oppressed in Western nations. So he says, the European peoples must first decide to wake up and shake themselves and stop playing the stupid game of Sleeping Beauty. So in many ways, these arguments are very similar to the ones advanced theoretically by Trotsky and then taken up in practice by the Bolshevik Party of permanent revolution. So that's the argument that the bourgeoisie had long since stopped playing a progressive, let alone a revolutionary role in society, and that solving the problem of national liberation and of ending the oppression of people in the countryside would involve a different class, the working class, winning leadership over the nation, winning leadership over the political movements, and thereby posing an economic alternative to capitalism, and that the permanency is that it happens everywhere across the world. It would have to happen to be successful. However, Fanon did not argue for permanent revolution, because despite the very excellent and correct critiques that Fanon puts forward, his arguments were weakened by his Maoist framework, which at core was about rejecting the revolutionary potential of the working class. And I'm going to spend just a bit of time, quite a lot of time, talking about why this is the case. So Fanon clearly did see himself as being against capitalism and being some kind of socialist, which was par for the course, really, in the anti-colonial movements across Africa. And the revolutions in Latin America, particularly in Cuba, seem to be the political model that Fanon looked to. And it's worth noting here that the Cuban Revolution was not one of a mass movement. So Fanon puts a lot of emphasis on the necessity for mass collective struggle. But that just did not happen in the Cuban Revolution. Fanon, in the case of Cuba, seems to think that although the struggle there was led by a minority, by a very exclusive guerrilla struggle, because it had the support of the masses, the actions of this minority could be considered mass and collective because they in some way were acting in the interests of the masses. However, if you track the political development of the Latin American so-called socialist states, actually, the critiques that Fanon has of the African post-colonial states, their tendencies towards authoritarian, towards one-party systems and so on, applied just as aptly in those situations. The Latin American states just as much consolidated a new ruling class with its own competitive interests and were just as much strangled ultimately by Western imperialism. And Fanon also, he speaks quite positively regarding the USSR. So he says that Khrushchev was a great friend of the Third World. He really praised Khrushchev's conduct on the United Nations. And it's possible that some of this, because Fanon was like a diplomat for the FLN, it's possible that some of this was about diplomatic positioning, because in the Cold War, the way to block with the USSR was to say that you're a socialist. So they're all different people who had extremely different politics and strategies who all said that they were socialists. That's definitely what happened in Ghana and in Congo with the political leaders there, just in two examples. But by saying this, I think that probably is why they were, because they're quite out of place, those statements about Khrushchev, when you actually read them. But just to say that doesn't mean that I'm making Fanon out to be some kind of cynic. He very clearly subscribed to the Maoist politics that were at the height of their international popularity during this period. So Maoism, in a nutshell, is the argument that armed rebellion led by the peasantry was the route to liberation from capitalism. And although it was seen as being a radical break from the stultifying Stalinist dictatorships, Maoist ideas were not fundamentally different to Stalinist ideas. because the political solution that they offered was still concentrating production into the hands, concentrating the ownership of production into the hands of the state. That is the end where both Maoist and Stalinist ideas lead to. And so I'm going to talk a bit about the peasantry, because that's the key social class that Maoists look to for as being the agents of social change. So at the time of writing Wretched of the Earth, peasants are people who live in the countryside and earn their keep by working off the land in some capacity. So they're a distinct class from workers. Peasants were the majority of the Algerian population. So for Fanon, peasants are the wretched of the earth. He argues that in the colonial countries, the peasants alone are revolutionary, for they have nothing to lose and everything to gain. So for Fanon, peasants faced the sharpest brunt of violent oppression under the colonial regime and derived no benefits from it. This meant for him that they could never desire to become assimilated into the colonial system or be satisfied with mere political reforms, but rather wanted to take the settler's place. That's like a really famous phrase from Fanon, take the settler's place. Connected to this, Fanon argues that peasants, because of their lifestyle and culture, were the true expression of the Algerian and indeed broader African national identity. By contrast, Fanon argues that the working class, which at this stage in Algeria were a minority section of the population concentrated in the cities, had become bought off by the spoils of colonialism. He says the workers, primary school teachers, artisans, and small shopkeepers have begun to profit at a discount, to be sure, from the colonial setup and have special interests at heart. He says that workers were a creation of colonialism, and thus they shared Western cultures, values, politics, and ambitions. So laying out the arguments in this way, Fanon argues that the interests of the peasantry were counterposed to the interests of the working class. And he puts a great deal of emphasis on the small size, like numerical size, of the working class, and saying that this means, their small size means, that workers could only ever advance sectional interests and they could never lead the whole population of oppressed people in the nation. So to test the veracity of these arguments, I think you have to assess, were the working class privileged under colonialism and therefore in favour of the system? And then secondly, did peasants have the social power to challenge the colonial regime? Fanon does not distinguish very clearly between social classes. Basically, under the umbrella of the urban elite, he lumps together political criticisms of very different groups, so the middle class, the intelligentsia, small shopkeepers, and workers are all lumped into that same mould. And it's wrong. This is quite a stunning mistake from Fanon, because Algerian workers very definitely did have interests that were totally independent of the bosses and the middle class, and they were very definitely oppressed. One element of this argument is universal. Wherever you go in the world, no matter how wealthy workers are, they are exploited and oppressed because they have no control over their labour and they produce luxuries for their bosses. But it's particularly stark in the Algerian context, because the conditions of labour in Algeria were absolutely terrible, and far from being totally disconnected from the peasantry, as Fanon argues, most workers in Algeria, because unemployment and underemployment were so widespread, they had a pretty much uninterrupted connection to their families and communities in the countryside. It was an important connection that let people live, helped keep people alive. And it was precisely because of this oppression, because of just how fucking shit it actually was to be an Algerian worker, that the working class played a very central role, not only in Algeria, but across the broader African national liberation movements. And Fanon acknowledges this in a backhanded way. He says a whole bunch that the urban, the Nationalist Party is urban, the rank and file of the Nationalist Party is urban. So just a few examples of the key and leading political role Algerian workers played in the anti-colonial movements. Algerian dockers refused to load war material going to trade in Vietnam in solidarity with the anti-colonial movement there, way before the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, which was when the Vietnamese struggle took on an international context. And in 1953, dockers and building workers in Oran led mass demonstrations against their government that involved more than 220 strikes and involved something like 270,000 people in total. And in Algeria, arguably, it was a series of 8-week-long strikes in October of 1961 that finally repulsed the French regime from that country. So far from workers in the colonies comprising a privileged, elite and exclusive class, they were rather very certainly oppressed and combative. So the second question then is, how were peasants to challenge colonialism? Fanon argues that because peasants have only ever known violence due to the oppression of colonialism, this is the only means they have to responds and express themselves politically. The thing to say from the outset about violence is that we should support the violence of the oppressed and reject all of the trite liberal moralizing that is so common in postmodern discussions about Fanon, which really predominate in the academy, which says that violence is bad and nasty and it's Fanon's weak point. So to say that you're for peace and non-violence in the context of oppression actually means legitimating the existing violence and the existing force by which the ruling class hangs on to power. There is absolutely no equivalence between the French state massacring 20,000 people in Sétif in Algeria to maintain an unwanted occupation and then guerrilla fighters resisting in some way and people fighting back for human dignity and basic rights. And also, we shouldn't be naive about the question of violence, because the ruling class minority who preside over mass brutality to maintain their rule never just roll over and give up in the face of opposition. Every revolution, by necessity, will require some element of armed struggle. We can't be naive about that. However, unless armed struggle is connected to and under the discipline of working class institutions, in itself, armed struggle can't move past the bounds of capitalism. So Fanon is insistent throughout Wretched of the Earth that hope lies in bringing together and educating the mass of ordinary people. But there are serious limits to how collective armed struggle can be. Like, you can call a mass meeting to discuss where to next for a strike campaign. You cannot call a mass meeting to discuss which government headquarters you should bomb. It just does not work that way. Military campaigns have to be tightly and secretly organised by elite individuals, even if they are supported by the masses. So for that reason, Fanon's really beautiful passages about the liberating and transformative nature of armed struggles, that through violence, the native discovers that his life, his breath, his beating heart are the same as those of the settler, they're only partially true. There's a general sense in which any kind of resistance can teach the oppressed new things, it can give people a sense of power, but it's only working class struggle that can teach the masses that there is an alternative to capitalism. Because when workers strike or take over their factories, not only can they exercise power by grinding society to a halt, they can point to a totally different way of organising production and therefore politics, everything to do with society. Instead of class rule, they can point to production being determined collectively and consciously by the majority of people. And it's because of this social and industrial power that the working class are able to wield collective strength and pose this alternative even when they are proportionally, numerically small. The classic example of this succeeding is, of course, the Russian Revolution, where a working class, which was numerically and proportionally much smaller than in Algeria, was able to lead a revolution that brought the peasantry behind it. So peasant guerrilla struggle just cannot pose this alternative form of economic organisation. And this is why a politics that does not seek to convince workers that they should run society can only ever lead to a different kind of ruling class and a different kind of capitalist state. Now, this weakness of Fanon's is the most frustrating because it's precisely Fanon's rejection of the revolutionary potential of the working class, which means he just can't provide a solution to any of the problems that he identifies. He can't overcome the limitations set by the national liberation struggle. And it's worth saying, or going through quickly, why there was no independent working class organisation of the kind that I described in Algeria. And it's because of the fucking Stalinists. Despite the heroic and long-standing struggles of the Algerian working class, the utter bankruptcy of the Stalinist communist parties and the lack of any organised opposition prevented the growth of a genuinely revolutionary working class politics. The French Communist Party, they were tied to Moscow and they had supported the occupation of Algeria for a very long time. In France, there was a massacre of Algerians demonstrating in support of the National Liberation Movement there, which was the exact number of people who were killed is unknown. And there are images of dead Algerians lying outside the headquarters of the French Communist Party and injured Algerians, like trying to find a place to stay. And the Communist Party had barred up their office. So they were responsible for the most horrible brutality towards Algerians. And tragically, the Communist Party in Algeria didn't entirely reject those politics, which partially, they broke with it in some occasions, but not entirely. And so this partially explains some of Fanon's arguments that the trade unions, Algerian trade unions, in which the Communist Party were influential in some places, were little islands of the mother country. So this is a great tragedy. The Stalinism and the Stalinist Communist Parties were, it was a great tragedy that they were the most influential groups purportedly talking about working class struggle and socialism. Because in Algeria, there certainly, when you look at the level of struggle, there certainly must have been an audience for, you know, an independent revolutionary perspective. But because it didn't exist in organised and interventionist form, there was no serious challenge to the hegemony of the National Liberation Front, which went on to become a one-party state and a repressive dictatorship, which is all of the things that Fanon vociferously denounced. But Fanon, his best quality, really, I think, was that he always saw himself as being one with the masses, and he chafed at his personal position as a middle-class psychiatrist, and he was always agitating to be part of the real struggle and take up arms, and he was deeply confident that the downtrodden would win. Apparently, because I mentioned at the beginning that he had cancer, he was dying, and he delayed treatment to be part of the Algerian Revolution. And apparently his last words to his comrades, Fanon's last words to his comrades before he left for the United States, finally relenting and accepting the cancer treatment he had delayed, were, "You are lucky because you will see an independent Algeria, but I never will." So he was absolutely certain that people could fight back and win. And you can see why the Black Panthers called Wretched of the Earth the Bible, because there's a universality to Fanon's quite strident appeals for solidarity and his absolute faith in the oppressed, his revulsion towards violence and all of that. Fanon's insights about national liberation and the need to go beyond a class society are still extremely pertinent, especially when we're faced with the new revolutionary uprisings in Algeria and Sudan against the caste of hucksters and profiteers that he so despised. But while Fanon's critiques and insights offer a searing takedown of the post-colonial states that emerged from the inspiring movements against colonial oppression, they cannot transcend the limits of the Maoist framework that he inherited. For that, we need the politics of socialism from below. Yeah, so I thought I might contribute, and then we can keep the discussion going. To respond to something that Jesse said earlier on in the discussion, yes, Fanon makes a series of critiques about peasant consciousness, which are absolutely correct. But this is the underlying frustration of the whole of Wretched of the Earth, is that he makes critiques about everything, about a lot of things that are very correct, about the party, about the nature of the state, and so on. But because he rejects the working class, what alternative can you pose to the critiques that you have? So I think that's the main point to get out of it. But even though he makes the that critique, his framework is still one that he argues explicitly that the only anyone who wants to look to fundamental social change has to try and organise the peasantry in some way. He says they're the only ones who can carry out a revolutionary struggle. They're the only ones who can really want to overthrow the system and who have a cult that he argues that peasant collectivity is in being totally immiserated. So he explicitly argues that for a peasant perspective, even if he has criticisms of them, where he writes off the revolutionary potential of the working class. He's like, oh yeah, a strike here or there is like okay, and the Nationalist Party can wheel that out when they want to prove a point, but workers are fundamentally bought off by trinkets because they have wages to buy things. That is the that is Fanon's quite explicit attitude. And so you could call Fanon a Stalinist, I think, in general, or a bourgeois nationalist. He never used any of these terms to describe himself. I think it's apt to say that he was a Maoist. Not only, I don't think the main criterion of, determining someone's, like, what political bracket they fall into is necessarily the states that they support. But he supported Cuba. There's, like, a million footnotes where he's like, Cuba's so fucking great. You know, Castro, what a good guy. Like, it predominates. But then the main thing about Maoism is having a hysterical opposition to the working class and also the looking to the peasants as the agent of change. I'm more critical of Fanon, I think, than actually some of the contributions that have been made here. Because I'm not sure I agree with what Omar just said at the end there. Because, like, I think that what, for all of the beauty of Wretched of the Earth, all of the strident moral appeals and so on, I think the most damning thing about Fanon was that he was in the National Liberation Front, and he nowhere made a direct critique of the National Liberation Front. And there's no evidence that in his practice, like as a political actor, that he tried to, and he was very senior, he was the Africa-wide diplomat for the FLN, that he actually tried to challenge the abhorrent practices that the FLN participated in quite early on. So I think that his, in the same way that it's better to look at what's, this might not be totally fair, but it's better to actually look at what happens, like in the in China, than to read the Little Red Book. I think you've got to also look at, like, Fanon never actually criticised the direction of the FLN. So he made all of these criticisms, but he didn't actually do anything to challenge the party which he was part of.
Give it to the final word over to Freya.
Okay, sounds like it's not going to be the final word. Thanks very much, comrades, for that discussion. So just, are you going to keep me to 3 minutes?
No.
Okay. Just wanted to say something actually in response to India's question really briefly about, I think that it's, the main thing probably that is taught about Fanon is the sort of postmodern abstract discussions of culture. But in some ways, Fanon also, the stuff about class, the class perspective, I think is important for understanding why he predominates in the academy as well. Like, there's the sense, Fanon was extremely popular in the 60s and 70s, where during the fall of the USSR, socialism, the ideas of Marxism, lost their appeal in the academy, and the ideas of post-colonialism were emerging. That is the moment in which Fanon was very popular, like as a figure. But in some ways, he pioneered some of the postmodernist definitions of class to do with, like, not your relationship to production, but where you live, your geographical location, the kinds of things that you buy. And it's in, even though I think Fanon was, he's been much maligned by the academy, but he, even though he saw himself definitely as some brand of socialist and Marxist, his ideas are often used to criticise Marxism because of his rejection of the revolutionary potential of the working class. But he's also used to, like, conceive of some supposed grand struggle between East and West, even though, again, that's not really what Fanon argued. So I think those are the reasons why he's a very popular person to study. In terms of responding to, did Fanon fight the FLN? Well, it it's like he had to be, his Wretched of the Earth had to be criticising the things that he saw within his own party. Like, he explicitly notes, but I think it matters, and it, as people who are actually activists, it should factor into our assessment of him, that he explicitly critiques, you know, Lumumba. He explicitly critiques what happens in the Congo. He does not critique what happens in the National Liberation Front, of which he was quite a key member. There is actually, Atulia reminded me, there are stories of, like, Fanon did try and argue his politics in some way to soldiers in the FLN, but he was also, he also knew about the FLN taking out more left-wing figures of their party and then didn't say anything about it. So I think that that just means that Fanon is extremely frustrating as a political person, because you can read the section on national consciousness, or the pitfalls of national consciousness, and it's very agreeable. Every moment it's agreeable. Bits of it are totally, like, alarmingly prescient. You're like, fuck, did he actually write this in 1961? But then he just goes back to he just can't transcend it. That's the frustration of him. And then what he actually did in his political life was just helping to establish that kind of a state. So he's a contradictory and frustrating figure who, main reason I have time for people who like Fanon is if I meet a young student who read him in class and thinks, I reckon we need violent struggle against the racist structures of our society, and I think it's good that he wants to fight. That's the main thing, actually the main thing that's good about him. But that's a very moral thing, because actually on the questions that matter, I think Fanon was very, very wrong, which is the solution to these problems. Responding finally to what Jesse said, I don't agree with this thing about the bourgeois nationalism thing, sorry, but, like, what politics you have, what theory you have, is not based on your self-identification. You're, like, I think you can quibble about what would you call Fanon, a Stalinist, a Maoist, a bourgeois nationalist, but his framework ultimately ended in bourgeois nationalism. He was in a bourgeois nationalist political party, and those are the metrics by which you could argue that that was a politics that he agreed with. The main the metrics to say that he was a Maoist, I think, were that he looked to the peasantry explicitly, that he was for armed struggle, and that his vision of socialism was state capitalism in some variety. Those are all hallmarks of Maoism. The only thing that makes that different from just straight-up Stalinism is the stuff about peasantry and the armed struggle, to say that's a distinct sort of body. And also, like, he explicitly... You need to read the footnotes. This is where a lot of his stuff comes in. He talks extensive... I'm not being snarky. That's where he says all of his stuff. He talks at length about how the Cuban example was of a minority liberating the masses and everyone was behind it. But also, he has passages where he says that in the current Cold War context, clearly the side of socialism, currently existing socialism, is favourable to capitalism. And he makes a series of arguments about why socialism is... currently existing socialism, being the key thing, is an expression of, like, yeah, collectivity and humanity, which capitalism destroys. What was existing socialism at that period? It was either the USSR or it was China or Cuba. Those were the states that people looked to. So that's the way that you can say... That's why I think it's fair to say that he was some version. He had a Maoist framework. That would probably be the most generous way to talk about Fanon. To end, though, like, this was some, you know, Wretched of the Earth, the critiques about... The thing that you can take from it in a good sense is that there is no... He was correct that no form of ruling class society could possibly liberate the oppressed. And he supported the struggles of the oppressed and thought that... party and organisation, arguments, teaching people about the way forward was totally crucial to the victory of any struggle. But he was wrong about how to actually do it. That would be my final line. Cool.